Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for wading through the bushfire smoke to join us at the Lowy Institute today. I'd first like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. My name is Kelsey Munro, and I'm a research fellow here at the Institute. I'm delighted to help my colleague Roger Shanahan present his latest research on Australia's contribution to global jihad. To quote Roger's own cricket analogy, in these China-obsessed times in foreign policy, the Middle East is like Steve Smith. Shunned for a time, but you miss him when he's not there, and then when he's back, it's the only thing anybody can talk about. In the past 7 years, several hundred Australians travelled to Syria and Iraq to join Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, or other radical Islamist groups. Dozens more Australians supported them financially or logistically in the planning of attacks overseas and on Australian soil. This wave of foreign fighters travelling from more than 100 countries to Iraq and Syria to join terrorist groups was unprecedented in its scale. And while the caliphate is no more, the ideology remains potent to some audiences. And so this extraordinary phase of global jihad deserves close attention. Of course, it's an issue that has received heavy attention from the media and politicians, but not always with a commitment to dispassionate analysis at the heart of that attention. So there are many preconceptions we have about the types of people who are radicalised or attracted to jihad, and so far, very little data to test these ideas against. So today we're going to discuss Roger's new analysis, The Typology of Terror, The Backgrounds of Australian Jihadis, and dig into the data that he has uncovered on 172 individuals known to have joined radical Islamist terrorist groups or who have been charged with terrorism offences. So Dr. Roger Shanahan is a research fellow here at the Lowy Institute, specialising in Middle East security and terrorism studies. A former army officer, he had extensive service within the Parachute Battalion Group and has had operational service with the UN in South Lebanon and Syria, with the PBG in East Timor, in Beirut during the 2006 war, and in Afghanistan. He was the former director of the Army's Land Warfare Studies Centre and has also been posted to the Australian embassies in Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. Dr. Shanahan has MAs in International Relations and Middle East Studies from the ANU and a PhD in Arab and Islamic Studies from the University of Sydney. He's also a part-time member of the Refugee Review Tribunal and a frequent commentator on Middle East issues in Australian and international media. He's appeared as an expert witness for several terrorism trials in Australia and is the author of Clans, Parties and Clerics, The Shia of Lebanon. So right after I ask Roger to the lectern to present his data and findings, we'll sit down and have a discussion about them, followed by an audience Q&A in which I'll take questions from the floor. So please do think about what you'd like to ask as you're listening. Roger.
Thanks very much for turning up. And I know this will probably be a relatively controversial subject, but as Kelsey said at the start, it's an important subject to actually grapple with because it generates a lot of heat, particularly politicians and their views on the nature of the threat, people within the community and their view of what the threat is or represents. But there's very little data to go by to inform these kind of commentary. Now, there are a variety of reasons for that, security reasons for that, the inability to get a whole range of data sets. But the genesis of this research effort, I suppose, is my experience in around 30 terrorism trials as an expert witness writing reports and having access to a whole range of data that wasn't available to anybody else. So that informed my way of thinking to start with. And a lot of that stuff comes out eventually when the sentencing remarks are said by the judges. There's also some very good media reporting about people in the community who've been charged with terrorism offences from journalists who've been dealing with this issue for quite some time. Social media throws up a range of other data sets as well, and also journalists out in the field who can provide access to primary sources there as well. So it's an aggregation of a range of data. And what we did, I suppose I have to say before we start here, this is not a policy document. So the Lowy Institute sometimes or largely writes analyses that has conclusions at the end of it that lead to recommended policy policies that should be adopted by the government. This isn't one of those kind of papers. It's a data aggregation paper where we have some observations, but it also raises and doesn't answer a whole series of questions, which I think will come out during the Q&A after. And that's good in a sense, particularly for a research organisation, because it points us in some directions where there are some anomalies or some issues that really need a much deeper dive than this paper can provide, and that requires a lot of research effort, and that research effort really, and there's no way around it, unfortunately, in this kind of space, a lot of data mining, so sitting down and listening to, watching and reading a whole load of social media data. I was helped in this by Jennifer Percival, who's sitting here at the front, who has been maintaining and adding to the database, which is quite a difficult thing to do because there are lots of data sets that we looked at. They can constantly change, and she lives on the south coast and comes here once a week, so sometimes we got confused between which version of the document we were talking about, and then we had to hand it over to the digital editor who had sometimes a third version of what we had. But I can assure you that they all in sympathy at the moment, so what you see is what you get. And I suppose I'll just talk a little bit about the methodology, about how we came up with this and what we are representing. So there are two pieces of research product that we are providing today, which are free and downloadable from the Lowy Institute website, and I hope some of you have done it so far. A hard copy of the working paper will be available later, but the digital copy is available now. So there is a working paper, which is essentially the research outcomes of this. And we have to understand that it is correct as at the 21st of November 2019. Additional data won't be absorbed into that working paper. So the analysis that we have conducted is current as of today. In many of those cases, that will continue to be accurate for a long time to come. In other areas, it may change as more data comes in. But certainly, the data sets that we have, the trend lines have been pretty constant. So in most of those subject areas, we don't think it's going to change too much. The digital version, which a PowerPoint presentation version is up there on the screen, will be a live document or a live electronic document. And we'll update it as more data comes in. So people who are looking at this to do an up-to-date analysis of how many people have certain characteristics, then by all means go to the digital version because the data will be kept up to date. If people are looking for analytical insights, the working paper is probably the best place to start at. Now, when we looked at people to include on this database, we have 173 individuals. We have the names of those individuals and the spreadsheet on which they're on. That's not won't be publicly available for a whole raft of privacy reasons. But who do we include and not include? We've included 105 individuals who we've classified as foreign fighters, as a catch-all term. That includes people from Australia who have gone and returned, or people from Australia who've gone, didn't actually get into Syria but intended to, and have come back and have subsequently been charged. It also includes women who have left Australia and gone over regardless of the role that they performed. What it doesn't include is minors, so people under the age of 18 who were taken over by their parents and didn't take an active role with Islamic State or Al-Qaeda based on the fact that they had no choice in the matter, they were taken over. We've listed them, but they're not reflected in any of the data here. When we look at the characteristics as well, we don't look at the function, so what activity they performed, we simply look at the ideological motivation, which is why we don't care whether you're a woman in Al-Hol camp or you're Khalid Sharif, who got killed with two of his children fighting for Islamic State. The ideology that took you from this country to join an organisation that was had taken up arms against Australia is the same, so we treat you the same. On top of those 105, we also have 68 individuals in Australia who've been charged with domestic terrorist offences as well. And the same rules apply there. We don't really care what you were charged with. Breaching an interim control order is treated the same as undertaking a terrorist act, because it's the ideology that we're interested in, the drivers that lead you to that endpoint or to support that endpoint, that we're interested in, not your function and what you did. So I'll probably just, when I speak with Kelsey in the Q&A, we'll talk about most of the issues to do that we've covered in this research project. But what I'll do now is just take you to a little bit of the digital version. So this is a non-interactive version, because it's just PowerPoint slides of the interactive version. And when I say interactive, it's slightly interactive. It's interactive for us because we can always change the data, but I'll take you to the part very quickly that is interactive for you and shows that we are actually, there is truth in advertising when we say it's interactive. When I spoke to our very young digital person and I said I wanted to digitally display a whole range of data sets that we had, I spoke about pie graphs and Manhattans and thought I was pretty cool. He looked at me like I was a kindergarten kid talking to a university student, said, just leave it with me. So he's got swarms. So this is, there are no pie charts, no Manhattans. They went out about 20 years ago, so I was told. And so we have swarms is the best way to represent this data, because while we have 173 individuals, we're confident we have every domestic person who's been charged with domestic terrorism offence, so that we have 100% coverage in the domestic data set. Never 100% sure about what we have in terms of the foreign fighter cohort. We have 105 names. Government talks about up to 200 people have travelled. We don't know whether they include children in that. So if you take the children out, you know, probably between about 175. So we've probably got about two-thirds of the foreign fighter cohort. So the foreign fighter element will change as you get more data, as will the domestic elements as we get more data as well. And at the top right of each screen, hopefully, is the coverage of the data set. So when I said we've got data sets for 173 people, we don't have entire coverage of every aspect of their life that we want to measure. In some we do, you know, gender obviously, we do know whether they're male or female, but there is a whole range of other ones that it's quite difficult to get that information. But in order to let the readers understand how accurate the data is, we show you how large the coverage of the data sets is. I won't. So you can see there for education, we've got just less than half of those people. That's a bit of an older slide, so don't worry about that. It's 171 rather than 173. And we come here to the interactive bit. So where are people from? Overwhelmingly from Sydney and Melbourne, and in Sydney overwhelmingly from a cluster of suburbs. In Melbourne tend to be north and south clusters for reasons which we can go into later. But when you go to the interactive version and you put the cursor over one of those numbers on the right-hand side, it'll show you which suburb it is. So if you put your cursor over number 10, for instance, it'll show you what suburb 10 jihadis have hailed from. I think it's now up to 11 in the latest version from that particular suburb. But again, we've got pretty accurate coverage, 138 out of 171. It's now up to 173, so it's about 140 out of 173. So in that instance, again, we've got pretty good coverage. And at the start of this, there's also a correct as at date. So on social media, we'll tell you when the site's been updated, but everybody will be able to see at the front page on the bottom left, there'll be what date it's been updated and the data is the most correct at. So I'll flick through this, and the one thing that I just wanted to, talk about all these issues later, but the one issue which I'll start at the end so the three things most people like to start at the start, I'll start at the end. In this research project, we do a whole range of characteristics to understand the typology of the people who've been attracted to this radical ideology. But at some point, people who are charged and go through the legal system end up at court They're either tried or they plead guilty. And as part of the sentencing, it throws up some excellent data about the future prospects of people who have been charged and found guilty of these offences, which people, in my opinion, don't pay enough attention to, because there is fantastic data. In fact, the best data you can get, because somebody has made a decision for you. Over the course of a trial that goes for 2, 3, 4 weeks, the judge hears evidence for and against particular individuals, and during the sentencing hearing, they get submissions about mental health issues, saying they did have a causal effect, and the prosecution saying no, they didn't. At some point, somebody has to make an informed judgment about that. Judges are the ones who do that. Judges also have to, in their sentencing remarks, make judgment about people's true level of contrition, and I use that term advisedly, and they also have to make comments about their prospects for rehabilitation. So in those three aspects, and this data set covers about 42 sentences or sentencing remarks for 42 individuals. More comes out as we go along, so this data set will change, but again, it's been pretty constant as we've built up this picture. The first aspect is mental health. It's a controversial subject to talk about because there's two aspects to it. A, did the person suffer from a mental health issue or not? Somebody's got to make a value judgment about that. Judges do. So just because you claim it or a psychologist claims that you have doesn't mean that the judge will accept that. And certainly in most of the cases where they have claimed it, the judges have said that that diagnosis runs counter to the evidence that I have heard, and so I don't place any weight on that. In some instances, the person had a demonstrable mental health condition, and the judge then has to decide whether there was a causal link between that and the actions they carried out. So in legal terms, did they know right from wrong at the time that they did that or carried out that action? Now, in only two cases have anybody pleaded not guilty due to reasons of mental impairment. In both of those, the jury found them guilty. And in one of those instances, and of the people who have been found guilty or pleaded guilty, the judge has only found that mental health issues should be taken into account in 3 out of those 42 cases. So in reality, mental health is not a factor in violent jihadism in Australia. Much as people might say it is, it's not borne out by the evidence that we have. Contrition, and judges talk about true contrition, because simply writing a letter at the end saying, I'm very sorry for my actions, I've renounced my allegiance to Islamic State, is not sufficient. Judges require you to stand up, and as they say, contrition is a very human emotion, and so people need to see you say sorry, need you to stand up in a witness box and truly recant your loyalty. Very few have done that. Most on legal advice, because as soon as you stand in the box during sentencing hearings, you can be cross-examined. So most defence lawyers, they don't go up there. And in all of the cases, pretty well, judges place little weight on written forms of atonement. So there's contrition and true contrition. And judges have found very few, 4 out of 42, have they believed that the person before them is truly contrite for what they did, which is worrying. But again, you wouldn't get that sense from commentary, because nobody goes through the data and determines whether people are contrite and who determines who is truly sorry. Well, judges do. And the last one, prospects for rehabilitation. Now, always a difficult one, because how do you determine what the person's going to look like in years? And some of the sentences that have been handed out are decades long. But again, the judges normally have expressed it in 3 ways: good or better, some prospects, and not good or non-existent. And judges sometimes pretty reticent to say good or better, because what happens if you say they were good or better, the person's released and then they commit another crime, which has happened in the past. Judges tend to be a bit cautious on this. And what we've seen from that is that rehabilitation prospects are only considered good for just over a quarter of the people that have gone to prison. Okay, I think that's enough for me, and now we can explore the other data sets.
Thanks, Roger. So this is the first time anyone has pulled together a data set like this for Australia, but it has been done with some overseas cohorts. How does the Australian group compare with terrorism recruits overseas?
Yeah, it's sometimes difficult to compare like with like. So overseas, sometimes the data sets are excellent. Sometimes people have had access to police and law enforcement files, but they've either just concentrated on the foreign fighters because that was the immediate problem, or they haven't had the access to it or trial data, and they've done it off a range of interviews. So sometimes we're not comparing like with like, but in many instances we are. So it's fair to say in some instances great similarities between other Western jihadis and Australian, and those are largely male, so about 85% in the Australian context are male. Average age is about mid-20s, and that's pretty constant in Western Europe. America's like 27 or 28. So you're talking mid-20s, you're not talking teenagers. And the other interesting aspect that is common is majority of second generation. So in this instance, in the Australian instance, it's about 60% of these 173 are second-generation immigrants. That's pretty similar to the Western European experience. Now, the differences in the Australian context compared to the European context is the Australian jihadis tend to be better educated. The majority have finished high school, and percentage that haven't is about the same as the national average. They are largely employed in blue-collar jobs. They don't have a criminal record, which is quite different from the European experience. Two-thirds have no record, and two-thirds of the remaining third only have a minor criminal record, and we're including, like, driving offences in minor criminal records. And they come from two-parent households, so not broken homes. So that's where the Australian cohort is different to the European cohort. And I'd probably just add a note to that one. While that would, on that kind of measure, compared to other terrorist cohorts, they're better educated, better employed, far less criminality and from more stable households. When you compare them to the rest of the Australian population, their unemployment rate's about twice, a bit over twice the national average. They're more than two times as likely to be in a blue-collar job than the rest of the Australian population. And the percentage of single-parent households is over twice the national average of single-parent households. So it depends what you're comparing with. If you're comparing the jihadi cohort with mainstream Australian society, they're different in some aspects. But if you're comparing them with their European counterparts, they're completely different and much more integrated, say, than the European cohort.
I think one of the most striking findings was the rate in the Australian set, 34% first-generation Australians, 60% are second-generation Australians, and that sort of echoes overseas findings. Can you draw any conclusions from that? Because that's quite a striking finding in this data.
Yeah, it is. And when I said at the start, you know, there's some aspects from here that throw up good prospects for future research, this has to be one of them because... In the European context, if you're talking about an attraction to a violent ideology that allows you to attack your country, your own country, of which you're a citizen, if, taking for example, Western European jihadists, if you have high unemployment, low levels of education, high levels of criminality, you exist on the periphery of that society. So if somebody gives you an ideology that empowers you and says, rightio, you know, if you want to be better, you can strike back at that society and God looks well on you. You can understand the causal link between that because you didn't have a particularly good life here. Somebody's offering you a good life in the afterlife. You can understand, even if you don't agree with that, or I hope you don't agree with that, you can understand the connection there. In Australia, it's much more difficult to understand. So if you're employed, so if you went to a, state high school, which just over 70% of the jihadi cohort did. If you're employed, if you haven't had trouble with the police, and you come from a household where in the majority you've got two parents, life by most measures is pretty good, and you are married or have been married. So by most measures, kind of integration measures, you appear to be integrated. So why is it that you're attracted to that same violent ideology that people in Western Europe with a completely different experience of Western life is? I don't have the answer for that at the moment, and I don't think many people do, but it's certainly something that requires further research, because when we talk about integration, the Australian cohort appears to be pretty well integrated into society.
Is there a risk of unfairly stigmatising certain areas and suburbs or even mosques with the publication of this data? I mean, what's the research value of that residential data in this data set?
It's been brought up by other people, and I'm completely alive to the fact that people may use this information to stigmatise particular suburbs. But my view is that the way the debate has gone, the debate is largely based on both sides of this debate, has largely been fact-free. So it's the vibe. So we put data out there, and in the instance, if we go back to that location one that I showed you, it would come as no surprise to people in Sydney about the concentration of people who are attracted to a violent Islamist ideology come from the heavily Muslim suburbs in Sydney. That's not telling anybody that you didn't know before or that you intrinsically didn't think was true before, but at least there's data now to support that. In Melbourne, it's quite different. There's two clusters. So why in Sydney is it one cluster? And in Melbourne, it's two clusters. And the reason is in Sydney, they tend not to cluster the jihadist cohort, haven't clustered around institution. They've clustered around family. So that's why they're all clustered together. In Melbourne, there's two institutions that people are attracted to or have been attracted to. One's in the south and one's in the north of Melbourne. So that tells you something else as well. So not all jihadists radicalise in the same manner. In Melbourne, you're much more likely to be radicalised through an institution. Sydney, you're much more likely to be radicalised through family or social group. So I think there's a lot of valid analysis to come out of doing that kind of research and analysis, understanding that people are probably going to point to something and say, see there, I told you so. But hopefully I read the whole range of the data sets and it informs them in other aspects.
Does the data set report, I'm not sure if it's even possible to do so, but how they were recruited?
Yeah, this is when we talk about what to do next. This shows you who have been more likely to have been radicalised, but it doesn't show you the pathway to radicalisation. And that's individual for a lot of people. One of the interesting things that's in that is when you're talking about how widespread is this problem? Out of those 173, 44 of them are siblings from 19 sets of siblings. So, you know, how you radicalise can be in a really small, tight-knit group. And if we were to add parents who've been radicalised and first cousins to that, or marriage partners of those siblings, you know, that would take you up to halfway or over halfway. So, hopefully that's one of the other aspects that people will take out of this, that we're talking about narrow social groups that radicalise, and so you need to try and understand how do those groups coalesce around these ideas. But the one thing that, in my experience, that is shared by pretty well all of these individuals is an enormous capacity to download social media. Enormous. And that's the kind of research pathway that we want to go to next, but it's very time-consuming to understand who are the influencers of these people, because they do gravitate to certain individuals. Certain individuals in Australia who take them to a certain level, and certain individuals overseas who take them to the next level of radicalisation. And there's a rich field that needs to be out in terms of data analytics for that as well. And I think that's probably the next step in this kind of project.
Okay, so I mean, I suppose given we're talking about mostly people who travelled to Iraq and Syria, that the country of birth or ancestry might be a factor in people, foreign fighters going there. But that's not what you found in the data, right?
Yeah. So sometimes if you don't know why people have been radicalised, sometimes to help you narrow it down, it's to take away reasons why they haven't been. So in this instance, they haven't been radicalised because they've been unemployed. They haven't been radicalised because they've been poorly educated. And the other instance is they haven't been radicalised because they're native-born Syrians or Iraqis who feel a connection with their country and they want to do something for their country. Very few people with connections to Syria or Iraq in that. And intrinsically, you would think Lebanese will be the majority because a bit over 20% of the Australian Muslim population are Lebanese, and just on sheer proportions, you would expect more Lebanese than others, which is correct, but they're in double the proportion. So if it's about 20% of the Australian Muslim population are Lebanese, 40% of the jihadist cohort have one or both parents or were themselves born in Lebanon. Why is that? Yeah, again, another rich research field. You know, you could put up some, you could postulate some reasons. One might be, we don't know where they're from, but say if they're from northern Lebanon, Tripoli and north, then there might be some kind of affinity to families in Syria, historical affinities. The other issue could be that the figures are skewed because there are so many siblings. And if you have a couple of Lebanese families with multiple siblings who become radicalised, the figures are blown out disproportionately because we're just talking about a couple of large Lebanese families who throw the figures out, and we're not actually looking at double, we're just looking at an anomaly in the data because the families happen to be big and everybody's radicalised within those families. Simple answer is we don't know, but it'll take more research to get a better handle on it.
In Australia, we've seen some politicians seek to link terrorism to refugee flows in order to promote public support for hardline refugee policies. Does this data set provide any evidence of a link between refugees and terrorism?
No, and that's short answer is no. Long answer is it's difficult to – some data sets are difficult to get. Data sets about refugee status are difficult to get because you have to know what visa they arrived on or that their parents arrived on. You can't get that. Privacy reasons won't allow you to get that. That can be reported on sometimes in the media. If journalists, for instance, have been interacting with families for a long time, they know their backgrounds and they're free to report it. And it's sometimes referred to in sentencing documents, but there's no obligation for the judge to do that. It might just be part of the background information they include. So a very low level of people with first or second generation refugee background, about 6%, I think. And while we know that's not the totality of the data set, it certainly does back up the Director General of ASIO, who said there's no causal link, and I'm assuming that the Director General of ASIO has access to everybody's visa, what type of visa they came on. So when he says there's no causal link and our data sets, acknowledging they're incomplete, also shows that there's really no linkage between the two, I'm figuring that's in sympathy with reality. And when we look at the names and backgrounds of the people that we don't have that visa data on, yeah, it again supports that view that there's no real link between refugee intakes and terrorism.
Okay. And there's a lot in the European literature about the crime-terror nexus. So I think that means the jihad is more likely to have had a criminal record. You didn't find that here either.
No, and I suppose that's one of the surprising things. I assume there'd be more than it is because, you know, it gets reported a bit in the press, and about two-thirds or just less, around two-thirds, had no criminal record. And what is a criminal record? You know, we've divided into a heavy criminal record or a light criminal record or medium criminal record. And a heavy criminal record is acts of violence, jail time, what we would consider a serious crime, large-scale drug use or importation, anything like that. And small-time criminals might be no jail time, might be traffic offences. There appear to be quite a lot of traffic offences. Low-level, you know, marijuana use, for instance, or possession. So those kind of things. And even if you take those low-level pieces of criminality, that accounts for two-thirds of that one-third of people who have a criminal record. So essentially people who you would call serious criminals is about 12% of that terrorist cohort. So there's not a big causal link between criminality and terrorism.
What about, you had a slide up briefly earlier about education rates. What did you learn there?
Yeah, there's kind of interesting things here. One, people who don't complete amongst the jihadis, people who haven't completed high school is about the same, well, nearly exactly the same as the national average. That will change, obviously, but at the moment it's the same. Dropout rate from university is a little bit high, but pretty close to the national average of people who drop out. Over 70% went to state high schools, and about 17 or 19% went to Islamic schools. So, you know, obviously more than the national average going to Islamic schools, but more than the national average going to state high schools as well. And those that did go to university, this is one of the kind of pet topics of mine that I'd love to do research into this, and it's that contest between the humanities and the hard sciences. Very few people who went to university who became jihadis did humanities. So now, is that because hard sciences doesn't promote critical thinking or attacking ideas? But it's kind of funny that, yeah, the 1960s era revolutionaries tended to come from political science departments at universities, where you argued about great ways of organising and being politically active. Jihadis, if you go to university these days, tend to come from engineering faculties, IT faculties, business faculties. They don't come from areas where you learn about history and politics in a dispassionate or objective way.
Right, that's interesting. So is it possible from this data set to sort of put together a coherent picture of the risks, or, you know, with counter-terrorism use, you know, what are we seeing as the main characteristics out of this cohort of jihadis?
Yeah, at this point in time, what we did, you know, just to generate discussion, I suppose, as much as anything else, is, you know, we shy away from the term average jihadi because there is no such thing as an average jihadi. Everybody's motivated for different reasons. They perform different roles. They have different backgrounds. So if we were to talk about the aggregated jihadi, that person would have the following characteristics. They'd be male, about 25 years of age, born Muslim, lives in Sydney, is married or was married, is employed in a blue-collar job, having finished education at a state high school. They aren't contrite for their crimes. They have no mental health issues, and they have poor prospects for rehabilitation. So on the first aspect, they have the same characteristics as a large proportion of the population in terms of employment, education, where they live. At the back end of that, they are completely different from the rest of the population in that they've committed terrorist acts for which they're not contrite, and it doesn't look like there's a good chance of them being rehabilitated. So the two appear to be disconsonant with each other, and so that's one of the things that hopefully further research will shed a bit more light on. Why can you be integrated and kind of average in society, but yet not only undertake these actions, but not be sorry about undertaking these actions? It's, you know, it's something that I haven't been able to answer yet.
Okay. And look, Roger, this will be my last question for you before we open to the floor, but you write in the working paper that accompanies this research how the scale of this episode of jihadism has been unprecedented. What made Islamic State's campaign to recruit foreign fighters so successful, and what are the counter-terrorism lessons, I suppose, from that success?
Yeah, I suppose there's probably two aspects to it, and I alluded to one before. People left out, you've got to break it up into phases. People went to the conflict from 2012. The people who tended to go that early that we know about and were jihadist in inclination were really had a predisposition or were already on authorities' radar for al-Qaeda links or affiliations. So there was a kind of, right, that's where al-Qaeda is currently, that's where I'm going to, it's quite easy to get there. And the accessibility has always been a big issue. So the early ones were al-Qaeda who are already of that ideological orientation in terms of radical Islamism. The next wave, which is the much, much bigger wave, didn't have that background. And so they were influenced by a whole range of issues, social media a massive one. So social media played such a big role, and Islamic State just understood the power of social media. They were very professional at producing it. Their ability to get it out immediately to tell this narrative and to be on message for the whole of the time was unprecedented. And on top of that, it's very easy to get to Syria, either through Lebanon, although it was a lot more difficult, but flying to Turkey. Tens of millions of people go to Turkey every year on holidays. Who's to say that you're not getting off to head south or and go to a resort, or you're heading south to cross the border? So the ease of getting there, the power and the reach and the professionalism of the social media. And I think this goes to the kind of last point. Why did so many Australians go here, even though they weren't connected to those countries, whereas very few went to, say, former Yugoslavia, where there were potentially the same kind of drivers there? And modernism and communication and a sense of immediacy and identity has to be part of that, because something could have happened in former Yugoslavia. You might see it on the 7 o'clock news, a bit kind of dispassionately and objectively reported on. You might have relatives there. They might phone you on your landline and tell you what's happening and saying it's bad. But hearing something on the landline or seeing something on the 7 o'clock news or reading it in the newspaper, 2 days later, there's no sense of immediacy. It's not going to prompt you to do anything, and it's not going to change your identity. If you can see live streamed activity, or you can hear speeches live, and you can see a package of Islamic State vanquishing their foes and putting up the flag of Islamic State, showing how powerful they are, and we just need more people, and the more people we get, the more powerful we'll be, it's the immediacy and the sheer volume of this information that has a compelling narrative that tells you, like it is, even though it's not how it is, that you believe. And it's easy to get there. So I think that's what's driven its modernity, has been part of the reason why we've seen so many people going to Syria and Iraq, where we didn't really see them going to a place like former Yugoslavia. So you would potentially draw the conclusion that if there's another area of activity in the not-too-distant future, or the distant future, that sense of immediacy can still be imparted. So I think the problem hasn't gone away. It'll continue on in some way, shape or form at some point in the future, because there'll be a pressure point that will attract people for the same reasons.
Okay. All right, look, I'm going to open to questions from the floor. If you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone. Let us know who you are, and please no speeches, so we can fit in as many questions as possible. Yeah.
Thanks. Fantastic. Just to be sure, your data set did not include any people who've been convicted of crimes in Australia in the name of IS or...
Yeah, no, yes, it did. So out of 173, 105 are people who have either travelled to overseas to fight, a few who have come back. So essentially that 105 is if you left this country, whether you got in there or not, you're included in that 105. The 68 are the people who have been charged for domestic terrorist offences related to nearly all for Islamic State, a couple for al-Qaeda.
And I mean, one follow-up. Was there a marked difference in your analysis of
set that had gone away and that that had stayed?
No, and I mean, that's a good point, and probably what I should have said at the start. we, for our purposes of our spreadsheet, we've divided them up between overseas and domestic, but for the purposes of this, we haven't. And the reason we haven't is two reasons. One, as I said at the start, we're interested in the ideology, not the function that you perform. So if you're providing cash from here to a fighter in there, you've signed up the same ideology as far as I'm concerned. And so you have the same ideological motivation. The other issue is nearly... So the government was very big on passport cancellations and refusals and got better as the time went on. So a fair proportion, we don't know the exact totals because, again, privacy rules, but it comes out in court and there are some other reports about who has their passports cancelled. Nearly half of those people, about a third of those people that we know of out of that 68 had their passports cancelled or refused. So they would have been foreign fighters were it not for the fact that passport had been cancelled. In fact, some of them, the whole rationale, which they've said and was recorded for undertaking terrorist attacks in Australia against Australians, was because they were stopped from killing people over there. They said, well, my jihad is no longer there, my jihad is here, and that's allowable as well. So from a researcher's perspective, I think, if you look at the ideologies, we just smash them all together because characteristics that we want to look at are the same.
I'm just wondering, does your data set include and did you become aware of during your research any instances of jihadists that were travelling to places other than Iraq and Syria? So were there instances of foreign fighters going to the Philippines or Libya or anywhere of that type?
Yep. Well, there's famous tinny terrorists who were... have been convicted in Melbourne, Musa Serantonio and his four co-accused, who originally the thought was they were going through through Indonesia to get to Syria, but then they concluded that no, they were actually going to southern Philippines. Musa Serantonio had lived in the southern Philippines, but I think the judge... I'll try and remember the exact quote, but the judge said the most ill-conceived idea since the launch of the SS Minnow, I think were his words or close to his words. They're the only ones that I know of. What we do know is in some of the foreign fighter pipelines, they realised that after a while, simply going to Turkey and then heading south was getting difficult because security authorities were more on the alert. And some people, their attempts to send some people through as far as Afghanistan, so send them to Afghanistan and get facilitated on a land route into Iraq and then get used. So, no, the southern Philippines with the tinny terrorists was the only instance out of that 173 that weren't going to either Syria or Iraq directly or through a circuitous route.
Thank you very much. That's been really informative. I was just interested to see if your data had been measured against non-jihadi ideology, such as the far right or the extreme far left, and the differences between those kind of fighters.
No, and that's a good question. I'm kind of expecting more of those questions. Probably two reasons. Short answer is no. One of the reasons is, to best of my knowledge, only three Australians have been charged with far-right extremist or terrorism charges come from the far right. So I can't compare three against 173, so there's not enough data to do it. Jennifer Percival is about to hopefully undertake a PhD research project in exactly that question that you raised. So short answer is no, because it's quite difficult to do at this stage, but I think it's also a rich and underdeveloped area of research. But in the Australian context, because we were just looking at the Australian cohort, there's just not enough to compare it against, I'm afraid, and difficult to get that. And I don't think any of them being completely through the courts yet.
Is it because we haven't actually put our attention on gathering that kind of information?
And we've basically focused on gathering more of the jihadist Islamic type of data?
No, I suppose it's, yeah, I'd argue, without knowing the priorities of the security agencies, because limited resources have to be apportioned to where you believe the greatest threat was, just the sheer volume, I think, of people of jihadist bent relative to the other ones would dictate that your resources have to go there. And in a perfect world, there'd be sufficient resources to cover everything equally well, but the reality is there's not. So I don't think it's the fact that we've taken our eye off it. I think it's the immediacy and the size of the problem just overwhelmed people's attention. I think, and again, I'm no expert on right-wing extremism, but when you're looking at the nature of radical jihadism, they're against the state. So radical jihadists don't see themselves as part of the state. And in terms of threats to the state as opposed to criminality or threats to individuals or community groups, radical jihadists, I would argue, are at the top because they don't acknowledge the authority of the state. Yeah, right-wing extremists would acknowledge it, disagree with the policies. Radical jihadists reject it. So when you're looking at do they represent an existential threat, ideologically, yes, they do. Practically, no, they don't, because there's 173 with, dozens more, but so they're not going to bring down the state. But they want to. They would like to. Aspirationally, they want to. So I think intellectually, I would deal with radical jihadists in a different way to right-wing extremists, not discounting the threat that right-wing extremism potentially has. And we were just talking about this before, but if, one area that hasn't been researched and I think would be a good research is we know a number of Australians have joined the Kurdish forces and we know a number of Australians have joined Ukrainian forces. There is no comparative analysis between what has driven them or an analysis of their social media data that I'm aware of and comparing that with how jihadists go. That would be a really interesting research project, but, we haven't done it.
I might take this opportunity, if there's no more from the floor, to ask the last question. Roger, given the scale of the phenomenon foreign fighters from Western democracies going to Iraq and Syria, was it because there was the caliphate? Will we need to see another sort of extremist Islamist-governed territory to get that scale of people recruiting again?
To see that scale, I think you would. Because for a while there they projected strength and they had semi-delivered what so many before had promised, a self-governed territory that you could actually get to. And so that was, a serious attraction. But people had been attracted, relatively significant numbers of people had been attracted to travelling and definitely supporting those movements before the caliphate was declared in the middle of 2014. So it's not the entire story. People were still attracted to that ideology, but certainly they turbocharged after June 2014. So I think to see that scale of attraction, you would have to replicate in some way a self-governed, self-declared Islamic caliphate or the equivalent. But you would still see in the future people attracted to the never-ending fight if it pushed the buttons of sufficient people. And I think, one of the things that we'll bring out in further writing that we're doing, this is kind of an objective research thing about looking at sets of data and not describing things. It's not a descriptive research task. So you don't get a sense of the personalisation of what the most fascinating thing I find is when you read and listen to what people are talking to about when they talk to each other. So we can talk about, mental health didn't have an impact. Why would you be attracted to it? When you hear people talking to each other, and particularly people who are Australian citizens talking to each other or people overseas about attacking other Australians, it's quite sobering. I find, even if we're talking small numbers, it's just, as a person born and raised in Australia, like most people, I can just not contemplate anybody talking in that way. How could you even formulate the ideas that you would think would be okay to attack and kill your fellow citizens in pursuit of an ideology. And not, yeah, they don't really care who you kill. In many of the instances, I just want to kill as many people as I can. And if it's around Anzac Day, that's even better because that's got symbology for them. It's never other Australians, it's them. So with that kind of mindset out there, I think, as we said before, you won't see the scale, but you'll still see people going and wanting to undertake these kind of actions because it defies logic why people would do it. So you could come up with as many legislative mechanisms to stop people doing it, and I think the government has been pretty effective in doing that. But in a free and liberal society, you know, you can't lock down society. People are still free to express themselves in particular ways. But if that those thoughts and those actions develop in a particular direction, you hope the government stops them before it gets there, and by and large they do. But that doesn't mean people won't continue to do that in the future when you live a kind of a life separated from broader society and particularly immerse yourself in the social media world, which becomes your reality, not Bly Street reality, Yuguna reality in a three-bedroom house, hunkered down, looking at social media for 12 hours a day.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much, Roger, for your fascinating insights in this really important topic, and Jen, for your work on and the research as well. I'll take this opportunity here to sneak in a plug for the Lowy Institute's podcast, Rules-Based Audio, which I host. You can hear more of Roger's analysis on the latest in Syria in a recent episode, among other fascinating conversations. Next week here at the Institute, we have two great events. Wednesday, we're talking about the disinformation era. Can democracy survive social media? Timely, perhaps, after what we've been talking about social media here. And on Thursday, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott is going to give an address on China. You can go to our website for details. Thank you all very much for coming.